Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast that's just too damn hot. My name's Corey Hazelhurst and my partner in propaganda is Steve Haynes.
Hey, Corey.
Before you get excited, listeners, that's a purely literal sense, we have to say.
I have literally just taken off my shirt and am actually just sat here recording this in my vest. That is not even a joke.
I'm sure that's a mental picture you wanted, listeners. You may have noticed, in fact, that this week we have had a heat wave. This is a slightly shorter episode than usual, all about climate change issues in 2019, not just in Britain and Europe, but across the world as well. With a heat wave in Britain and in Europe, and might have noticed this isn't the first heat wave we've had in Europe. There was a heat wave in June and July. So I had friends who went to France on holiday in June and they said it was 41 degrees. I think the highest temperature it got to was 45 degrees, which coincidentally, That's not weather temperature. That's the temperature you keep the takeaway on in the oven. That's the temperature you keep the takeaway on in the oven while you eat your starter.
Yeah, it's a wonderful thing. That is almost kind of like fry and egg territory, actually, isn't it?
Yeah, basically.
Yeah.
Obviously, this has a bit of an impact in terms of mortality. So, but there were 15 deaths just in Europe in June and July alone from that. In that heat wave, and I suppose it's just a little bit of a sign that our planet's becoming a little bit more uninhabitable. One thing we thought was interesting on the back of that is there was a story that got some traction, which was London will have Barcelona's climate by 2050. And there was an interesting article on The Conversation, which we'll put in the show notes, from someone who was sceptical about this. So I think essentially what they've done is put pairs of cities together that they thought in 2050 their climate will be similar to this given the emissions and given the rise in temperatures and all that kind of stuff. And this academic said that's probably not quite true. They didn't quite see London and Barcelona as being similar cities. I mean, just to give a couple of examples, Barcelona is a lot denser than London. So Barcelona is one of the most densest cities in Europe. I think it's got about 16,000 people per square inch, something.
Square mile.
Again, Boris Johnson's premiership, Steve, we don't need facts anymore. London's more like 10,000 per square inch, which then means Barcelona's a bit hotter. But also then London has more parks and green space. So places around Richmond, which tend to have more parks, tend to be cooler than those in the inner cities. They tend to be 10 degrees cooler than those in the inner cities without parks.
Yeah, absolutely. So there is actually, when it comes to changes that are happening in terms of the climate, there is actually a lot of nuance in terms of what the actual outcomes are likely to be, which oftentimes in the reporting of these sorts of issues gets missed. In a lot of ways, it just boils down to the basic kind of scientific illiteracy, which covers an awful lot of journalism. Given climate science is very, very complicated, people tend to just kind of lean towards the nice, simple narrative in one form or another. Either it's another thing which says we're all doomed, or you know, the kind of counterintuitive bollocks of, huh, it's snowing, come on, where's that global warming they said was going to happen? You know, that kind of stuff. So I think it is quite interesting that we are actually starting to see, at least doing the rounds in some areas, some kind of more nuanced discussion of this sort of stuff in ways which are actually accessible as well. If you read the piece, it's actually really quite well written and very very interesting.
It feels like a shift to a language of climate emergency now, to kind of show it's not like global warming, it's not just, you know, moving to that climate change, climate emergency, which kind of makes sense, I think, doesn't it? We've also talked about how climate change is a geopolitical problem. And one of the reasons is we talked about the impact, say, on food prices, and then you have food shortages. And certainly there's evidence that some of the political unrest in Syria, some of the root cause of that is because of rising grain prices, because of famines and what have you. To take one, for instance, at the moment in Somalia, Somalia, generally, they have four seasons. So they'll have a rainy season between April and June, another rainy season between October and September, and then the two dry seasons, which are in the middle. And most of the population lives in rural areas that need water to grow plants. Again, all your art students with me, you with me so far, it's fine. So, of course, what happens...
We should just point out at this point, we both have masters in an art subject.
I've taught science, Steve, it's fine.
I've to done 8-year-olds.
Pushes and pulls, Steve, look. Light and dark, it's fine. But what's happened in Somalia this year is that the wet season was less wet than usual. Yeah. So there wasn't enough rain, and this means that crops fail, and therefore means that we have massive, massive food insecurity in Somalia. So animals dying and what have you. And essentially you end up with a vicious circle, because obviously if you that means farmers then have to sell the rest of the cattle that they've got to try and get some money to buy food, which then means they've got fewer cattle the following year, and it's just bad times, really.
Yeah, pretty much. This is actually where you're going to see the real impact of the change in climate. It's because actually, whilst we say, oh, London's going to become like Barcelona, actually, that's not necessarily, that's neither here nor there. What's problematic is that actually you're going to see places which are in the tropics or in places which are already very warm become borderline uninhabitable in one form or another. Not just because it's going to be very, very hot, but just because the weather patterns are going to shift and suddenly then you're not going to be able to grow food there, which in turn leads you to people having to leave those areas. And famines and things like that, which means somebody's got to do something about it, and people will inevitably fail to do something about it, which means people will then look to leave and they will jump on boats to come to Europe, and then we end up with a refugee crisis like we've seen previously.
Well, indeed, and I was going, yeah, and I think that's the point to lead on, is that we will see this in Europe in terms of those increasing refugees which will come, and we've seen it already with Syria, seeing it again with Somalia, and again the facts from Somalia come from a Guardian piece from a few months ago. They interview a mum of five who's in a an informal camp in Somaliland at the moment, who essentially weren't able to feed their family, so had to move out. Problem is, in terms of attention that Somalia gets, I mean, Somalia's mainly in the news when Donald Trump attacks Ilhan Omar. Really, yeah. It's not part of our popular...
Or pirates.
I don't think, a lot of world attention that there is a crisis there. And so, therefore, aid agencies there don't necessarily get a lot of funding in terms of charity stuff. In fact, in the Tory leadership race, there was talk of cutting foreign aid anyway, and I'm guessing that the foreign aid budget would be spent on things like this, no matter what the right-wing press would like to have you believe. So, again, you have a little bit of a spiral, really, where... A refugee crisis provokes a hard right reaction here, which leads to demands to cut aid spending, which means there's fewer resources to deal with the impact of those areas on the ground.
Yep.
Another geopolitical situation not being helped with weather is on the border between India and Nepal. Now, India, like Somalia, also has a rainy season. So the monsoon season, you might have heard of, big showers. Again, taught geography at primary school, know all the facts. Part of the issue with the climate emergency at the moment is that those monsoon rains become more and more unstable and more prolonged and unpredictable. There have been some tensions on the border between India and Nepal, partly because on the Indian border, lots of dikes have been built to try and keep out floodwaters, which means that floodwater from the monsoons gets diverted into Nepal, and that's been affecting Nepalese communities. It's been affecting their crops as well, damaging them, damaging livestock, which has led to increased tensions on the border there.
Increasingly, what you will find, I suspect, over the next 5 to 10, 15 years, is more and more kind of tensions of such as this breaking out. And eventually, these are going to end up kind of spiraling into something a lot more serious than just, you know, fish shaking and saber rattling. If you are actively flooding somewhere, you're flooding one of your neighbours by your policies, there is an awful lot to be said that that is an act of aggression in some capacity, especially when if you are refusing to stop it for whatever reason. And you could very much argue that your neighbours could be justified in taking some action to prevent that moving forward. In which case, you end up in a situation where someone like Nepal sends in their army to deal with whatever the flood defences are on the Indian side to prevent their people from dying. At which point, you've then got invaded that country to deal with this, in which case you've then potentially got a war. And this is just one of those, like, it sounds ridiculous, but this is actually where we could be going with these sorts of things.
So I'm reading Homo Deus at the moment, which is Yuval Noah Harari's look at the future. One of the things he says about the future is that there will be fewer war because more people now are, well, one of the stats he quotes is that more people die from suicide than they're killed in war every year. And there used to be that wars were endemic between countries and they were wars often fought over natural resources. And this, I mean, often this is why empires form, isn't it? Again, big brushstroke of history, but countries fought over stuff, over access to resources, big natural resources like maybe oil or grain or food or what have you, or money or gold. But this is why countries went out and conquered other countries, was to get stuff. There you go, Hazelhurst's theory of history.
It's not wrong.
Now, you could have situations, and people are positing situations, where you have wars fought over water in the future. And maybe he addresses it later on in the book, but it feels to me at the moment, actually, that, I mean, there have been James Bond films about it, so I suppose, you know, anything's possible, really.
When we talk about kind of like wars for resources and things like that, we tend to almost talk about oil and you know, fossil fuels and things like that. But the reality is, actually, you're much more likely to get wars over water breaking out in places like Africa, because you are, as the climate shifts and the climate changes, and we get to a point where a lot of areas that are already tropical and very warm become more inhospitable, you're going to see more drought, you're going to see more famine, the water tables are going to drop down, in which case areas which have, you know, steady supplies of water are going to be very valuable to governments. At which point, who knows, maybe you do end up in a situation where Nigeria invades somewhere in order to maintain access to clean water supplies. That is entirely feasible as an outcome. God knows, I hope we don't get to that sort of point, but it is absolutely possible.
And if wars do exist, then you're going to have increasing refugee problem as well.
Yep.
I suppose this is the thing, I suppose, with the interconnectedness of the world. Like, you can, we assume it's interconnectedness over technology, but I feel like there's not quite so much as joining the dots over this sort of thing, necessarily. I think we made the point in our podcast on climate change that it's not really necessarily an area that environmentalists talk about.
I think there's two things that feed into that. One is the fact that foreign things are over there. Foreign things are things that happen to other people, and we don't need to know about them. We don't need to really concern ourselves with them, just because that's kind of how an awful lot of how the Western kind of like mindset is. It's very much built around, in fact, it's not even the Western mindset, it's just the human mindset. It's built around your in-group, and it's, this is where you are, these are the people that are around you, these are the people that matter to you. Everybody else is over there in the out-group. You don't really care that much about them, so why would you go investigate them and see what's happening over there, and why would you care about what's happening over there? So you've got that element going into it, and then what you've also got is almost like a failure to understand the systems in place. And I don't mean this in terms of like the weather systems or the kind of like the climate science itself, although there is obviously, as I said earlier, kind of like a lack of understanding on that on pretty much all sides. And we've been joking about you kind of teaching, like, you know, science and geography and things, but actually there is a bit of a basic failure to understand even basic human geography kind of like tenets, like push and pull, the factors in why people would move from one place to another, and people not necessarily thinking, if this happens, what does this mean? People not understanding that there is that wider context to these things. So yes, it is terrible that there might be water shortages in Somalia, but people aren't then going thinking, and then what does that mean? And they're not thinking in that kind of context. And I think that is largely where you're going to see problems in the West, because we're not going to think like that, and therefore we're not going to be prepared for what happens.
So in terms of the final thing maybe that we could talk about, is the mental health impact of climate change, which again, issues of mental health, something which are being discussed more and more now, generally, which I think is a really positive thing. But there's a couple of articles on the impact of the climate emergency on ordinary people. and on climate scientists themselves. First one, which I thought was really interesting, is a Mother Jones article in which they interview climate scientists. It talks about scientists essentially not quite suffering from depression, but various of anxiety-based disorders, essentially because A, they are researching quite traumatising things. So they might be looking at habitat disappearing, species being wiped out, that sort of thing, in modelling the impact of CO2 emissions on the Earth and the terrible consequences that might happen there. So it's partly just looking at those traumatic things, which reminds me in a way of, there's been other articles, let's say, looking at like Facebook comment moderators and those who have to...
Yeah, the people who delve into having to actually moderate, you know, images of paedophilia and things like that, where it turns out it's not a very fun job to have, and they end up kind of in very poor mental health as a result of it, because in most positions where you have to deal with that sort of stuff, like, say, the police, there's normally a department to help you deal with that, not so much at Facebook, and I'm guessing it's going to be a similar case, and not so much at the universities where you're studying climate.
It's fine. I bet Nick Clegg's on it. It's fine.
Hmm.
Yeah, I know it's similar, because I think the Facebook comment thing is a really good example, because you get traumatised by watching lots of traumatising things, and maybe it also starts affecting your mind as well, because I think there was someone who's had to see so much Holocaust denial material that he starts thinking, well, maybe there is a poor thing, maybe it didn't happen.
Yeah.
But also, so part of the other reason for that sort of mental health issues among climate scientists is because of the increasing denialism. Coincidentally, after Donald Trump starts office, and essentially you've got people who see these terrible things and then are ignored and told it's not true, and the impact that has.
Yeah, I mean, there's a massive thing, really, in relation to kind of like climate change, and of how it seems to become like a populist cause to be against climate science and say, oh, this doesn't matter. It's all an exaggeration. Everything's going to be fine. I've got no idea why. One would assume that, like, I can understand why certain right-wingers who are funded by certain businesses and things like that might go down that route, because if you're getting all your money from Shell or BP, then, yeah, clearly they're not going to want to talk about those sorts of things. And in certain parts of the US, absolutely, that would be the case as to why we've kind of gotten into that mess. But that transition from it just being some bent politicians have had their votes shifted by donations to it being something that the right rails against it bemuses me, because it makes no sense. Because we discussed previously, as you said earlier, that we've talked about climate change as a kind of like a national security issue and things like that. It's something that can potentially work in their favour. It's something they should care about, because it is going to be a root cause of something they dislike broadly, which is more immigration and more illegal immigration at that.
The thing from the right, it's partly because of the funding. I think it's also because partly it's seen as being a kind of big government conspiracy, because from the left, I think it's seen as, well, what's the solution to climate change? The solution is that essentially you have government producing running everything. You have bans on and restrictions on flying, on what you can buy, on what you can use, what you can eat, like all those things in people's daily life, thinking about, you know, their meat consumption, their transport, all comes into play. And so that kind of visceral reaction to, as they would see it, a big government program, they assume, well, climate change is therefore just a ruse to get lots of left-wing stuff done. And I think that's part of it. Maybe it's also a part of it seen as being a kind of liberal elitist thing, whether it's kind of wonky scientists or vegan hippies. I think it's also because you talked about the funding of big companies and of free market think tanks in particular. And I think partly it's because the thing with big companies and the thing with free market think tanks is they don't really believe in the free market. They believe in unfettered capitalism. I mean, we will talk about the Lib Dems, and we'll talk about, you know, Ed Davies decarbonising capitalism and that kind of market-based approach, which is essentially, well, carbon emissions are a negative externality that you have to pay for, and the way you pay for them is with a carbon tax. That's one free market solution. Another free market solution is pollution permits or like pollution vouchers, where you're given a certain amount of vouchers and you can sell them off. So I think the idea is carbon trading. Yeah, carbon trading, exactly. Now, if you're on the left, those are seen as anathema because essentially they're prone to exploitation by big companies and it maybe keeps capitalism and they don't want it. But the point is, if you're on the right, these are free market solutions you can use, but the right don't want to use them because they're not really actually properly capitalist and free marketeers, and the left don't use them precisely because they're not free marketeers. So they kind of, I mean, you are left either with the Lib Dems or with a certain wing of the Labour Party.
Yeah, and there's not a lot of call for those sort of solutions, which actually is a shame, because actually a number of them are quite sensible and can actually deliver. He says, clearly being on that wing of the Labour Party.
And then I suppose then the issue is, does that electorally work? Because obviously then Australia brought in a carbon tax a few years ago, but in one of the more interesting elections this year, a more left-wing environmentalist Labour Party lost to an Australian Liberal government that was against environmentalism, carbon tax, all that sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, Australia is an interesting case study for this, but it might be a case that it's not necessarily going to be indicative of other places, simply because Australia is really conservative. And I mean that, we like to say America's conservative, but it basically goes America, Australia, the rest of the West. And I'm not even joking there. Coal mining and things like that have a massive kind of part in Australian culture in the same way that it does in the US. So it may not be typical. So I think you'd find a lot more leeway for that sort of policy in Britain and in Europe than, say, in Australia or the US.
And I suppose then the final kind of way that climate change is seen as a impact on people's mental health is just on ordinary people. And I think there's again another interesting article we'll put in the show notes about the effects of climate grief, essentially just more ordinary people, either mums having to explain to children the effects of climate change, or even children themselves about the kind of world they're going to grow into. But it does, in America anyway, the American Psychological Association said they've issued a report on climate change's effects on mental health, part mainly through trauma with extreme weather, which we've sort of talked about before, but also because there can be lots of different emotions, you know, lots of dire warnings which on the rise of sea levels and stuff, which can lead to fear or anger, feelings of powerlessness, feelings of exhaustion as well.
All of which are things which feed into your mental health and tend to be the things which can exacerbate underlying conditions or anything like that.
Which I suppose kind of feeds in the opposition to the right, because the whole point, I suppose, as we said, is that these things are connected. You know, the climate change is connected to the migrant crisis, refugee crisis. It is connected to the way in which we eat, the way in which we travel, the way in which we live. It is connected to the fact that we feel stressed and unhealthy. And maybe it's the failure of a lot of the right to try and recognise that, which means we're in a bit of a pretty pass.
Quite possible.
Right, we'll end there, shall we?
Yep.
Okay, we'll be back next week, probably talking about the ridiculous situation in Britain. I mean, this goes out on Sunday. Maybe Boris Johnson isn't Prime Minister now. There might have been a confidence vote.
It's entirely possible.
The banter heuristic demands it, Steve. In the meantime, our website is notenoughchampagne.com. Our Facebook page is facebook.com/notenoughchampagne. Dave Depper is responsible for our theme tune, and James Cram designed our logo. You can follow him on Twitter @JamesCram. I'm @PaperbackRioter.
I'm @AcousticRadical.
Happy plotting.